Hello, everyone. This is Abdullah Samia. I'm joined with Murad from Australia, and we're going to be talking about something very interesting, a social issue, a religious issue, a change in the world, a new challenge to the uncontested strong man in the ring, the uncontested religion of Islam. The last and final religion sent to mankind, no doubt, from the last and final messenger of the one and only true God, Allah. We're going to be talking about this big change that we are noticing, change in society, change in the community, change among people. And it's very much an iceberg of a change. It's something that you can only see a little bit of it sticking up, but there's a lot of things going on under the covers. Me personally, I don't know a lot of public ex-Muslims, but day by day there's more and more people that are coming out publicly and saying, yeah, I'm not Muslim. And they're okay with that. So, there's definitely a shift going on. So, like I said, I'm here with Murad. Hi, Murad.
Hey Abdullah. Hello everybody.
How's it going? What time is it over there in Australia, other side of the world from
It's
Canada?
morning time. It's 8 o'clock. I've just had my breakfast and my coffee.
Oh, nice,
I'm
nice. So
raring to go. It's
the
Friday and it's my day off.
angels must have just left you and they're on the way to visit me, because and Allah's come. Sorry, not the angels. I meant Allah. Allah comes down to the lowest heaven. So your lowest heaven part is done. I guess he's over coming over to Canada now, because it's just about getting dark right now. It's going to be nighttime soon over here. So it's
He's
our
on his
turn.
way.
Yeah, it's our turn for the blessings. So how are you doing?
I'm doing well. It's Friday, my day off. I'm looking forward to the weekend. Going to be going to a comedy gig tonight with my wife, so that should be fun.
Awesome.
And it's a beautiful day. It's an absolutely gorgeous day out there today.
Amazing. So tell us more about yourself. What I mean, obviously I didn't mention it, but you're an ex-Muslim. So talk about, how is Islam part of your life? Just let's go over that a bit.
Okay, just quickly, I grew up Muslim. My family from Bangladesh. We fled the. I was born during the war, the Bangladesh War for Independence, the Liberation War, as it's called sometimes. And my family fled the aftermath of the war to. We went to England, and I grew up there. Grew up as a Muslim. Used to go to the mosque. Used to go to the biggest mosque in London at the time, and grew up, within the faith, and believed. Like I was a massive believer at the time. But I always had questions. Always had questions, and a lot of the questions didn't get answered. And a lot of the questions weren't even allowed to be asked. And I think this is an important thing to kind of keep in mind as we go through this talk is that central idea that a lot of doubting, skepticism and stuff inside me, and I saw in other people, there were no discussions around these kind of ideas of, oh, if I apply logic to this question, or if I apply logic to this idea that I'm being taught, why are we not allowed to discuss it? Why does it get met with so much shutting down of discussion, shutting down of debate? There are certain lines of thought that were forbidden, essentially. That's what it, felt like growing up. So, I started to question probably in my teens, and found no avenue to just, have a Have a frank, open, honest, accepting discussion with anybody, with people at the Quran classes I used to go to. I think there was a level of fear that prevented people from talking about their doubts. I think that's a fair point to make, and I think that's probably quite recognizable to a lot of people who are watching now, is that idea that, oh, we can't talk about this. any questions that we have. And so then, as I grew up, I essentially got to the point where I no longer believed, but everything I was doing was kind of pretending to people that I believed. And so I essentially found myself, as we say now, in the closet of being an apostate, but
Why did
still
you
doing.
and why was that? Was that like, did you feel you had to do that, or what was the situation?
I think there's I've kind of tried to figure this out over the years, and I think a couple of things. One was definitely fear, because growing up, if we put a foot wrong, going, in Quran classes, if you put a foot wrong, or if you ask the wrong question, or if you're a bit cheeky or whatever, we'd essentially receive, corporal punishment. You'd get a beating. You'd get we had to do little things like holding books out at the ends of our hands, kind of
Wow.
like stress positions, all these kind of things that make little children afraid. Then the other thing would be the idea of hell, which is pretty scary, especially when you're a kid, because I used to believe that. I used to literally believe that if I question, if I speak my true mind, then there's something wrong with me. There's something evil about me. But there wasn't. It's just a curious, inquisitive mind that children have, to try and figure out the world like anybody else. Children are trying to figure out, oh, how does the world work? How
Yeah,
does the universe work?
it's funny how like you can ask a question and the answer is like, "A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim." Like, I seek refuge in Allah from shaitan. Like, that's the answer you get to like some of the questions, meaning like, don't go there, like, let's not talk about that.
There's a careful kind of ring fencing of your thoughts to prevent you from going out into the realm of the disbeliever. So we have to have this ring fencing of thought, in order to keep people within the faithful. And I think that was the thing that used to worry me, as I grew up. And after all this questioning, turning around, turning it over and over in my head, I eventually decided in myself, without telling anybody, without telling a soul, because without telling a soul, I decided, okay, well, I don't actually believe any of this anymore. I don't believe that Allah is as described in the Quran. At first, when I kind of became agnostic, I don't believe that Muhammad is anything but just an ordinary man. Just an ordinary man with all his, qualities and failings and problems and weaknesses, just like any other human being. And once that happens, then the whole religion kind of really doesn't make sense. Once I kind of got to the point of, he's just a man. He didn't have any special powers. He didn't have any special connection to the divine any more than, if the divine exists, any more than anybody else. And so then that made me think, okay, well, I can't really honestly say that I believe this anymore. But when I left, I did it by stealth. I kind of just stopped believing, kept on, pretending as I was, which
How old were you? Like, when was this?
I think eventually this would have been just over 20 years ago, when I so I would have been late 20s.
So you were
Yeah, so
definitely
yeah,
an
just
adult. You definitely, yeah, like, you were not a kid. You knew,
no.
you've kind of at that point, you've kind of explored the world. You're still looking, still learning. 21 is quite a young age, and that's quite impressive, because I actually converted to Islam, or Sunni Islam, around that age, around 18.
Around that age.
It's an age that people
Well, if
are
it,
looking, right? Like, you're searching for the truth, you're looking for something, you're looking for a bigger piece of the puzzle, you're trying to figure it out. So for me, it was Islam, but for you, it was like, okay, the other way.
Well, I think the if I look at, say, I don't know if you've ever heard of Erikson, who wrote a thesis on the idea of psychosocial stages of development in humans. And he said, you know, at certain ages we have certain kinds of development, and some of them are around the 20s, you know, around ideas of identity, ideas of kind of like purpose and meaning, etc., all of these things. And then they change and shift as we get older. You know, he saw kind of parallels between lots of different people and kind of said, oh yeah, that's how it happens, and it will happen at certain ages for people. Some people
Right.
will obviously develop at different times and have different things come up for them, but those kind of big questions, I guess, are
Yeah.
things that we think about at certain ages a lot more than others.
Definitely. So then you found the way, you found your way out of Islam. You felt some sort of social pressure to kind of not say this out loud, would you say?
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
And this was
I
in
I'll
like
tell you I'll
London?
tell you a sorry.
This was in London at the time.
Yeah, this was in London.
Okay.
One of the sort of like pivotal moments that made me realize to that I was afraid to speak up and to say anything was the whole Salman Rushdie affair.
Oh.
And you know, satanic verses. So he'd written the satanic verses. This was what, late 80s. And I remember watching a show, which was a debate show with a guy called Geoffrey Robertson, who is an Australian lawyer. And he had a show, which was kind of like a show about hypothetical questions that people would ask, and then the panel would discuss them. And this was just after Satanic Verses and the fatwa on Salman Rushdie. And on the show was Yusuf Islam, also known as Cat Stevens. And Geoffrey Robertson put the question to him, you know, in a perfect Islamic state, would Salman Rushdie be, you know, should he be killed? And Yusuf Islam essentially said yes.
Wow.
He said yes. Because of his blasphemy, he should be killed.
Gee.
Now, the irony of this, or the ironic kind of situation I found myself in, was that going to the mosque that I went to, I used to see Yusuf Islam
Yeah.
walking around. So we'd walk around and people would say to me, oh, look, there's that guy. He used to be Cat Stevens. He used to be, you know, big singer. And then he converted to Islam, and now look at him. He actually set up a school, or helped to fund a school, an Islamic school in London.
Yeah.
And, you know, so like I used to see him at the mosque. And then I used to think, oh, that man thinks that if you have blasphemous thoughts or blasphemous ideas, you should be dead.
Yeah.
And so that's going through my head as a, you know, as a teenager, and I'm thinking, oh,
Oh,
I have to stay quiet about this stuff,
wow.
you know, like who's going to accept that? Like if I say, well, actually, there's no way Muhammad flew on the back of, you know, an animal.
Burak.
You know, yeah, exactly. There's no way all of these things, they didn't make sense.
Yep.
Solomon didn't talk to ants, you know, all of these kind of things. Like I just, all of these ideas that I had, like, they just didn't fit with reality.
Yeah.
And when you discuss them, this is where the debate ends up, is that, oh no, you can't say these things. You can't say what Salman Rushdie said without getting a death penalty, you know, applied to your head. So I
Yeah.
kept quiet.
It's interesting how, to me, how even in a non-Muslim majority country, a secular country, I think, depending on what you mean exactly by secular, you still had this fear, you know, to actually publicly leave Islam. And you know, it's not just that. I mean, we didn't even go into like, you know, how would your family react? How would your parents have reacted? We're just talking about like, you know, how comfortable you feel just to say that. And even, and this was 20 years ago. So, I mean, things have changed a lot. And so But like the fact is that even back then, it wasn't, I mean, it's not that long ago, it's still during my life, your life, people are scared to openly come out and leave Islam, which is interesting. I think people don't realize that how difficult it is for a Muslim kid or even a Muslim adult to like come out and say, yeah, I don't believe in that anymore. It's not just the indoctrination, it's a cultural kind of tolerance or whatever you want to call it. Like it's acceptability of leaving Islam is just not there in the community.
I think I mean that whole phenomenon fascinates me. And I've essentially like the I've written a novel, and I've tried to capture that sense of being a person surrounded by people, but that person doesn't believe what everybody else believes. So it's kind of like, walking around thinking, oh, gravity is not real. That everybody thinks gravity isn't real, and you're the only person who believes that gravity is real. And then
Is
going,
it
oh,
like
well, how do I discuss this? How do I even open up the discussion on this when we don't have a language to discuss these things because it gets shut down so easily,
And why do you think so many people are leaving Islam now, if you want to kind of move to that? Is it the fact
Well,
it's shedding religion? That's what you that's that was your comment you sent me. And how many are in the
what was
closet?
that? What? Yeah, how many are in the closet? Because if we take like so, if we take the thing of let's say take the Shahada and realize that when I was growing up, I was taught that even if 2 minutes before you die, you say the Shahada, you are now Muslim, and everything's going to be okay. And that was one of the fundamental points of that kind of like broke my belief, because I just thought, how can you just say one line and that leads to your eternal salvation kind of thing? Like that's it's just one line, it's just a single thought. It doesn't, really, it doesn't change the universe having that one thought in your head. It's not going to, magically open dimensions that you don't get into if you don't believe that thought. But
It's
as
interesting,
to
like
what,
it's interesting this emphasis on belief. It's like it's more important than anything else. It's just like even more important than actions. It's like the thoughts in your head. But yeah, continue, sorry.
No. That's a really good point. And I think for a lot of people who become disbelievers, there is a realization around that there is a material difference between thinking something and it being true. It's not true just because I think whatever it might be. Just because I think one thought doesn't mean it's true, just because it happens to happen in my head. So I think once people start to question their own thinking, they may realize that their thinking, their conclusions, their beliefs aren't as a result of exploring or experimenting with the world or analyzing the world. It's just that they've inherited these beliefs and ideas from having grown up. Like you said, you've grown up Muslim. These are all the things that you believe. The family believes it. The people around you believe it. Therefore, it must be true, which, isn't. That's not. That doesn't follow automatically, that just because everybody around you believes it, therefore it's true. That's not what happens. But as to why, going back to why people are leaving so much, so I think one of the first things I've kind of thought about is the whole phenomenon of the internet at the moment, and the proliferation of people talking about this in a way that I've never seen. And I think that's the thing. Like for years, I essentially just got on with my life. I didn't talk about Islam. I didn't talk to anybody about Islam. I didn't say anything to anyone about it. If people ask me, I used to say to people, I'd say to people, oh, I'm from Bangladesh and my name is Murad. And people would say, "Oh, are you Muslim?" And I'd be like, "No." And then I'd kind of like shift the subject away. But now, well, probably about 10 years ago or so, I started to say to people, "Oh, my family were, and I was born into Islam, but I don't believe in it anymore." And it was always interesting the reactions I'd see, because people who were Muslim would kind of do that, "What? How can you not believe in Islam?" And there'd be like this double take, and then would be the awkward conversation. But now I kind of enjoy those conversations with people, and to say, "Well, yeah, it's because this, this, and this. And what do you believe? And why do you believe what you believe?" I think that's an important point, to have those conversations. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, I was gonna say that's interesting. Like, well, one point you made is, you were just living your life, which is great. A lot of people think that like ex-Muslims, we don't do anything else. We just talk about Islam all day. And I mean, the reality is that somebody needs to talk about it, right? I mean, everybody talks about Islam. I mean, with Muslims, you have pretty much every Muslim. Not every Muslim, but like a lot of Muslims will give money to the masjid, will donate to different Islamic causes. And so you have this huge amount of wealth, and people will volunteer their time for Allah's cause, and people will donate, and they'll do all of these things fi sabilillah because they expect they're gonna get something back. So it's like, yeah, you scratch my back, Allah will scratch your back five times, right? Kind of like that. So they're doing something, they're getting something out of it. So there's the def the balance is always going to be imbalanced, right? Because if you're a humanist or a secular humanist, or you're an atheist in general, there's no actual benefit. Nobody's promising you rivers of milk and honey and large-breasted young women that will lowering their gaze away from you, and it will be in pavilions and tents of this and that and whatever. We don't have any, no one's offering us that, right? I mean, maybe that's why there's always this thinking that somebody must be paying you, because I'm not doing any of this stuff except so I can get something. So somebody must be giving you something. Otherwise, why would you want to talk about this stuff, right? And I mean, they don't see that there's, I mean, sometimes it's an interesting conversation to have, and sometimes you want to help other people because you were able to help yourself. And so you want other people to kind of see your thought process and how you were able to get out of it, so that they can get out of it as well. Because there's a big huge world outside of the prison of Islam, right? As Prophet Muhammad said, that this world is a jail, a sijin, right, for the believer. And life is good outside the jail, man. Like, come on, guys. Like, we just want to have a talk with you. Join us. We got the good life out here, right? And you don't need to worry. You don't need to feel guilty all the time about, things that don't really matter, right? And at least let's have a conversation. That's all we want to do, right? But we're also gonna live our lives. At the end of the day, some of us will spend some time doing this, and some of us won't. That's fair. Everyone has to choose for themselves. But yeah, like you were saying, definitely things are changing, eh? So did you answer that question? How many are in the closet? Like, what's the answer to that?
Well, this is the thing. Like, I think, let's take the pew. I sent the link there. I think we should put some of the links in the thing afterwards if we can. But the link to the Pew research in the US about how many people are willing to say anonymously, obviously in a poll, in a survey, how many are willing to say, "Yeah, I have no religion." Muslims, people who were born Muslim, who are now saying, "I have no religion." And on that Pew survey, it was 23% of people born Muslim in America are now saying, "I am essentially not Muslim." So that's 23% willing to say to a stranger, and obviously anonymously, that I'm no longer Muslim. Now, I'd say a percentage of those will be still in the closet. They will still turn up to the mosque. They may even fast. They may even go to Hajj. But in their heart of hearts, in their mind of minds, deep down, they're like, "Well, I don't actually believe any of this. I'm just going through the motions. I'm just paying lip service, which is what I was doing. And I, so like I'm not here to, I'm not here to shame them or to say they need to come out of the closet or anything, because I totally understand why people are in the closet in the first place and why they don't want to say to friends, family, to their wives, to their husbands, to their children. You know, they don't want to say I've essentially left Islam inside me. So now
That's
I don't know
interesting.
what the numbers are of people who are Muslim in America. What is it, like 10 million maybe more?
Maybe,
So 23% of that is a, that's a fairly sizable number. You know, when I essentially left in myself 20 years ago, 20 plus years ago, I didn't even think it was some a couple even why I'm not a Muslim. You know, a few people here and there. That was what I thought. I thought it's a tiny, tiny percentage. But now I realize it's probably often been a lot bigger than that. You know, I think, you know, historically it's probably been bigger than that, a bigger number. But people aren't willing to come out and say it.
In my
So
personal
that's an
experience,
interesting thing.
being who I am, I get to talk to a lot of people. And okay, so if I had to count the number of people I know who are ex-Muslim versus the number that I know that are ex-Muslim, not Muslim anymore, and actually say it, like I can count on my hands the number of people I know that are publicly ex-Muslim. And I know so many people who are ex-Muslim, but they don't say they're ex-Muslim. So I know a guy that teaches in a school. It's an Islamic school, but he teaches like secular subjects. I know a guy that his own brother contacted me and said, "I want to talk about Islam." And I was like, I messaged his brother. I'm like, "Does he know you're not Muslim?" He's like, "No, don't tell him." I was like, "Oh, interesting." I mean, I have friends who are struggling even to tell their wives that they're not Muslim. And some of them, they've told like the kids and they didn't tell their wife or the ex-wife. Some of them, they've told more people, some haven't. But the common trend is like the vast majority of them, 99, probably like 90%, are not public about their lack of faith, right? And so I think this is something that needs to change, but it's slowly happening. Like people are becoming more confident. The challenge is the cost can be very high, right? The cost can be very high. Like when you came out, like you're out, you're coming on video, you're doing this. I mean, do you have any personal losses that can happen because of this? Because I know a lot of people, either the wife would leave them, or they wouldn't be allowed to even see the kids sometimes. The community would like boycott them or shun them or kick them out of the community. I mean, thankfully, me and you were adults, we're grown up, we're grown men, we work, we have a life, we have income of our own, we have our own families. So we're not under someone else's kind of financial care, which can make it more difficult. But like, isn't it even for you, wasn't it kind of like a risk in some sense to come out?
I mean, when I first realized and started to kind of say to people, even tentatively to say to people, oh, yeah, I don't actually believe any of this, that I found that really difficult to do. I found it, I found that the fear of being rejected by the community I'd grown up with, the people I'd grown up with, the pain it might have caused other people as well. I think I was always really conscious about that because, you know, if say for instance my mother was to think, oh well, if you don't believe you're going to hell, that would be painful for her. So I often hear that as a reason why people say, they say, oh well, I can't tell anybody because they'll go through pain, and I care for these people to say, well, I don't want them to go through that pain of thinking, oh, you're going to hell, and therefore it makes your parents sad. It makes them think, oh, we didn't do enough to bring you up properly. We've brought you out here. I mean, in my case, we brought you out here to a Western country, and look what's happened. You know, you've turned kind of thing against us. Those little things are things that stop people from talking. They're things that stop people from discussing these things.
I want to just call out a friend of mine, his post he made, Reason on Faith. I'll post it in the chat in a second. Reasons why many Muslims haven't left. I think you might have seen this. And it's a pretty comprehensive list. And the one you just said is right on the about the parents and making them feel bad and sad and all that stuff. And actually, this is a really good list for those of you still in the closet.
It's a great list.
Exactly. So I'm just going to share that. But yeah, that's a good point. A bunch of people I know told me the same thing. They're like, I don't want to hurt my parents. And thankfully, my parents specifically are very liberal. So no loss for me. I'm really happy about that. My entire extended family, they respect people's freedom to believe or disbelieve. I love that. And I wish everybody had the same opportunity that I had to just like openly say what they want to, what they want to say and whatever, right? I mean, that's amazing.
And
That's
still be
such a blessing.
accepted.
Like my dad was like,
To be able to speak your truth and be accepted is, I think it's got to be a fundamental kind of need in humans to say, okay, well, I need to speak my truth and still feel accepted by you and loved by you, my community, by whoever it is.
It's a need for authenticity, and it's a need, it's a very, very deep need to be accepted and loved for who we are. It's intimacy. I mean, that's what intimacy is. Intimacy means that you expose yourself in a way that you can get hurt, and you put yourself out there, and still, people love you for who you are or accept you. They don't have to love you for it, but I mean, they accept you. And that's something, the other thing you made me think about is how, Yuval Harari in his book, Sapiens, he mentions that two of the biggest needs that for people are family and community, even more than wealth and health. So, he was saying that you can even get like, let's say you get diabetes, studies have shown, or you break your leg, or, some sort of permanent disability. As long as you don't keep getting like worse and worse and worse, people tend to adjust, and they make do. Whether you make a lot of money or you lose a lot of money, whether you get some sort of disease, people tend to adjust to it, and the happiness levels return to what they were before the illness. But family and community are two of the things that like we're really hardwired, and we need them, right? And so this is why, like, if you're leaving Islam, you're leaving Mormonism, which is another very difficult kind of community and religion to get out of. There's a lot of there's a big challenge. I mean, you lose a lot. I mean, your happiness level can go phew, and so this is something that people struggle with. I mean, there's a lot of mental difficulties that ex-Muslims go through, very much because of the fact that they're not accepted by their families and communities. And so this is a massive challenge for anybody to lose the community that they grew up in, right? And the older you are, in a sense, the more difficult it is. So the younger you are, you can still make new connections, you can make new friends. If you're in university or college, you're like, you just you can make your kufar friends still. But like, if you're like in your 40s and your entire life is Islam, especially the more religious you are, the more difficult it is, because you tend to cut off non-Muslims from your life if you're, some extent, more or less, if you're more religious, right?
And I mean, because you're taught to, don't take friends from amongst these people. And that was, I remember hearing that message a lot. And I think one of the things, like, because you've mentioned Mormonism, I'd say the Jehovah's have similar experiences. What I found was one of the things that humanized a lot of stuff for me, humanized a lot of people for me, and humanized my own experience, I guess, was talking to other people and listening to their stories. So listening to the stories of people who had been involved with Jehovah's, had been
Oh.
Jehovah's Witnesses and were, essentially shunned when they left. Talking to people who were Mormon who had left, and obviously talking to ex-Muslims, realizing that there are lots and lots of similarities, but also unique, kind of like quite unique issues, because I don't think any of the Mormons or any of the Jehovah's ever said, "Oh, I got threatened with death by someone on Facebook for saying that I'd left the Jehovah's, or I'd left Jehovah's Witnesses and stuff." And
You
I think
see,
that's the thing. That's
are you saying they didn't get death threats? Is that what you said?
So they never said, "Oh, I got death threats." They just got shunned completely. They were
Yeah.
just like completely shunned and stuff.
Yeah. That
Whereas,
I was gonna say that's pretty.
I've had threats of violence towards me, for saying what I've said. And it's like, oh, well, that's interesting. Why is that?
How bad has it been? Like, so for you, are these all like online threats of violence, or did you ever have it in real life?
A couple, like face to face
Wow.
ones, when I was younger, and I just thought, oh, okay, I'll have to be quiet about that and not say anything, because like that's what happens if you say certain things. I mean, even at the mosque, people, if you question things too much, they would, like the teachers would readily give out beatings for, like the wrong question, asking the wrong question at the wrong time,
Wow.
kind of thing, So that fascinates me. And I think the there's an author, and psychologist called Marlene Winnell, Dr. Marlene Winnell, and she talks about these aspects of community, these aspects of belonging, identity, and the trauma that people can go through when they have to disconnect, because the central ideas of the religion no longer fit with a person's own authentic self. And that kind of pulling away, that disconnecting, can be really, really painful. I think, and you can see the similarities between, like said, the Mormons, high control groups, that rely on conformity, in order to keep people within the religion. And I think that's, like Reason on Faith's list there, that's a lot of the reasons. There's so many reasons why people don't want to say that they've essentially stopped believing. And the benefits you get from saying you've left, are what? A sense of inner freedom, I guess. And it's like,
Yeah.
okay, so I've got that sense of inner freedom, but it doesn't get me money. It doesn't get me a lot of kudos in my community. People aren't going to praise me
Yeah.
for saying I've left the religion, it seems like a painful path to step.
Yeah, the
But ultimately it is, freeing and liberating, and realizing that I don't have to essentially waste my time doing a lot of stuff that brings no benefits whatsoever.
Yeah, absolutely. This is an ongoing challenge, I'd say, for many, many ex-Muslims, which is like the cost of coming out versus the benefit of coming out. And I feel like at some point, it's a choice everybody has to make for themselves based on the personal costs to them. For me, like, I've never got an in real life threat except somebody tried to get me to lose my job. Multiple people actually had some sort of campaign to try to get me fired. But that was like the worst thing that ever happened to me. The online death threats, I got tons of them. I don't take them that seriously, because they're online and it's so easy to throw them out. And people, you know, like when they're using a fake name, if anybody gave me a death threat or any sort of threat of violence in real life, I would take it very seriously. I would go to the police. You know, maybe the intelligence agencies, Canadian intelligence agencies would be involved. I mean, I would take it, like I would get a lawyer, I would put a restraining order. I would take all the steps I have to take to deal with this person. Thankfully, for the most part, other than, like I said, some people, I don't know who it is, trying to like hunt my personal life. The Muslim community has been okay with me, I guess. Not happy about it, but not trying to kill me either.
No. And I don't think that's, you know, and I don't want to paint a picture as if the whole community would want that, especially in Western countries, because I think people can be accepting. And this is one of the things that I've realized, that the conversation has shifted so far compared to when I left. Okay, and that's the thing. It's interesting talking about the community as a whole, like Muslim communities being more understanding, more accepting. And I think so for instance, even online, there's say organizations like that Muslimish, I don't know if you've seen it,
Yes,
Muslimish.org,
I'm
you
a
know, and they're a lot more kind of like inclusive, a lot more open to debate, a lot more open to discussion. They're kind of their thinking is not so rigid, not so concrete. So they've like gone, oh, look, there's people who think different to me, and that's okay. There's people who grew up in Islam and they don't believe half of it, or 75% of it, or 80% of it, or they even, some people will still call themselves Muslim but just think that Muhammad was just a man. You know, there's a massive spectrum of people and beliefs. So I think it's wrong to kind of paint a picture of it being a monolith and that there's only one set of ideas. There's like, you know, the whole thing of like there's 2 billion Muslims, but there's 2 billion versions of Islam.
So I have
You
a
know?
you know like I have okay so there's a certain part of the community, there's certain people online, there's certain people in the world who want to make Islam seem like a monolith, and what they want to do is they want to take the most like literalist black and white ISIS like style Islam, and they want to say like, this, my friends, is Islam with a capital I, and this and these are Muslims who are following Islam, or maybe not following it, but they might follow it, right? So this is kind of, you know, desired by certain people to I guess it's fear-mongering. They want to make it seem like all Muslims, even the ones who just call themselves Muslims but they don't even believe in it, they're like they subscribe to this, or the like hypocrites or something, even though like I mean Islam is a man-made religion. There is no real definite, there's definitely more like plausible interpretations and less plausible interpretations, but who is to say, you know, the rules of how to interpret, you know, like basically the usul, right? I mean, there's multiple ways. I mean, there's people that are Sufis, there's people that are Salafis, there's Ahmadis, there's even people like Baha'is, right? That like they have Islam as part of their worldview, but they're not Muslim even, right? And then even among Sufis, there's like Sufis that are like twirling Sufis, and then there's Sufis that like they look for the mystical parts of Islam. I grew up in a sect of Islam that looked for the hidden meanings in the Quran, and they didn't even take the Quran at face value, and there was definitely no chopping off hands, and there was definitely Sharia wasn't like what people, you know, are trying to say it is, which Sunni Muslims would have a different interpretation, of course, but there's a plethora of Islams, right?
There is. There's a massive difference from one region to another. And then all the different schools of the different schools of thought that have grown up over the, you know, 1500 years. There's so much variety in it, and so many different ways of people practicing it. But what I see, so for instance, the kind of the flip side of that is, like, say, for instance, what's happening in Pakistan. There's that single sort of literalist interpretation that has proliferated, and no one's allowed to deviate from that. So, which is why you have, in the constitution, Ahmadis can't call themselves Muslim. You know, that's like that's where it does become legalistic and is anti-pluralistic. And those are the real sort of problems. But at the same time, you're right, there's a vast variety of ways of interpreting the Quran, or interpreting the scriptures, and people are living their lives totally differently as, under this kind of umbrella term of Muslim all over the world. And that kind of fascinates me, because when I grew up, initially I was taught that our way was the only way, was the truth. You know, essentially it was all, it was kind of like all takfiri on everybody else. And that just becomes self-defeating ultimately, because everybody does it then. It's like, oh, well, you're obviously not a real Muslim. And then this person says, you're not a real Muslim. And then this sect says, no, we're the real Muslims, you're not the real Muslims. And then that's, it just breaks down. And that's why I said there's, there might be 2 billion Muslims, but there's 2 billion different versions of Islam. Everyone has their own personal little interpretations that they take on as, this is my personal truth, this is my personal relationship. And yeah, trying to adhere to all the different versions and rules and strictures is always going to be, an exercise in futility, I think.
I think I get the idea of why people want to say there's one Islam. They want to say that because they want to show that it's incorrect. And when people say, no, I don't believe in that Islam, I think it makes, opponents of Islam frustrated, because then they're like, oh shit, now I don't know what to say. You're a Quranist. Oh, you don't believe in camel urine? Oh, you don't believe in Quran? You don't believe in, Muhammad gouging out that guy's eyes or whatever. Oh, now what do I? Now I don't know what to say anymore. You guys, you're not a proper Muslim. You should be following hadith. It's like, what? It's an atheist. You're telling the guy he should be following hadith? Why? Like
It's like,
Quranism is kind of harmless. Like, it's whatever. It's not true. There's lots of nonsense in the Quran itself, right? Like the Alexander, I mean, the Dhulqarnain going to the East and the West, and the, there's so many things. Allah's holding up the sky without any pillars and
Juj
whatever.
and Majuj, all of these things.
Juj and
I
Majuj.
mean, great mythological stories, great
Maybe
mythological stories, and
ex-Muslims are
that,
Juj and Majuj. They're
we're
coming from
gonna
every
cause it to
corner.
happen.
But here, we're
Yes.
like, so.
But I mean, I guess one of those issues, I mean, like I think going back again to the proliferation of stuff I've seen on the internet now compared to, say, 20 years ago, when I guess when the internet was in its infancy, really. But it's allowed the transmission of ideas that had no other place to be discussed. And I think that's why we're seeing, people such as yourself, Abdullah Gondal, Harris, Imtiaz Shams, all of these people everywhere, the ex-Muslims of North America, Reason on Faith, Masked Arab, there's just a vast list of people, a Heretics Corner, all of these people, you see them discussing these things in places where they are encouraged to discuss them. I think that's a huge paradigm shift, to see that people are encouraging each other to, hey, let's have this discussion, let's talk about why we don't believe, or what are the problems we see in the scriptures. Are they even true? Does Allah actually exist? All of these questions, which are, I think, natural questions, and natural questions that I think most Muslims will at some point encounter at some point in their life, even if someone is a completely devout, believing Muslim, they will encounter these questions at one point. But they may not have anywhere within their own community to discuss them. And that's, I think that's an essential thing. But now, you know, in the last 10 years, I've seen just a huge rise. I mean, I called it an apostasy tsunami, which I think it is, really. If you see 23% in America, that's a huge number. Or you could call it the Murtad Spring. I thought that was, you know, so it's like a, you know, it's like a flowering, a blossoming of different ideas of people wanting to go, oh, well, what about this? What if this is the truth? How do I know? You know, how am I going to discover? How am I going to explore these ideas?
And you're noticing this, right? Like, what are you noticing? What are your observations?
So I think, you know, and I'll go back to again the phenomenon of the internet and how the spread of ideas has been so quick. You know, it's instantaneous. Look at that. I mean, look at this. We're talking from one side of the planet to the other side of the planet, and we're having this discussion, and you know, people are going to be watching it now. People are going to be watching it for the next however long it's going to be up on YouTube.
Till the day of judgment,
So
my friend.
until the day of judgment, yeah, which could be tomorrow, I have no idea. But like
But day of judgment's on Friday, and your Friday is coming still, so you have a little bit more
So
time.
I'll get the day of judgment first,
I have an
and
extra
then you go, I'll tell you how it is
day.
before the day's ended. But just, you know, those things that the internet is really, really good at, the kind of like the viral spread of ideas, which can also be its weakness, because if there's a false idea, if there's a, you know, fake news, whatever, it can spread before people have even had time to fact check it. But it's also a great way of proliferating discussion and spreading good ideas as well. Then it's ubiquity, it's everywhere. You know, you can get internet pretty much anywhere on the planet, just about. You know,
But
some of
what
the
have you noticed?
polls.
What have you noticed from Muslims? Have you noticed, like you mentioned, a Bilal Philips video? You've noticed, like, this is what actually motivated you to have this talk, right? Yeah, and what have you noticed
So there was
from Muslims?
Bilal Phillips's video where he seemed worried. He seemed genuinely worried, and like, and there was, I mean, I think there was a certain kind of concern in him as well about, because if you know, take his worldview as being the right worldview, and he sees people, children, families leaving Islam, then it looked like it actually hurt him. It hurt, you know, like inside, for him to think, oh, people are leaving Islam, and it sort of it seemed almost painful for him the way that he was talking. That was my impression.
Yeah, and I actually
And
just to add a little bit more to that, I spoke to the boy who I know the guy who actually talked to Sheikh Bilal Phillips. He doesn't want to, doesn't want to come out publicly, but yeah, you're right. Like, he felt bad that, like, this guy is leaving Islam. And I think he doesn't know what to do about it other than go, like, his old advice was, migrate to a Muslim country, which is what he did, right? Like keep your kids in Islamic schools, like, keep them away from, like, I guess, all of these things, right? And like, work hard on your kids. Islam, 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 Islam guys, Islam guys, everyday Islam, have halakas and do everything in your power, because it's a losing battle, right? I mean, honestly speaking, it's a losing battle against the truth, and from our perspective. But continue, sorry.
From our perspective. Yeah, because that's often the response, isn't it? That's okay, just you need to pray more. If you pray more, then you'll get the right answer. But what happens if you pray more and you get the answer that they don't want to hear? That, oh, well, I prayed and I meditated and I thought about it and I asked and I kept coming up with the idea that the book is just a book and Muhammad is just a man. This is what I kept coming down to. You know, I'm like this personally. I'll tell you a dream I had once, and I still remember this dream. I had a dream that, you know, when I was really, really struggling to go, oh, is this real? Is this not true? Is this true? Is this not true? And I had a dream. I was standing on top of a building, and I realized this is like a Gedanken experiment almost. Like, I realized that I had more faith in gravity working on my life if I jumped off that building than I did in, than I had faith in Allah working to save me.
Oh, yeah.
And so, like, that's like, okay, well, there's my empirical level of, okay, well, gravity, I have faith in. It's been empirically proved to me that it works. You know, I see it work all the time. Allah, meh, I'm not really sure. You know, he doesn't really seem to work. He doesn't do much. You pray, sometimes it doesn't work. If I pray to gravity that it works, it will work. You know, that's essentially it. That's like, that's quite an absolutist sort of like position, but it's like, okay, well, that's what happens, you know.
And the thing is, I mean, that's the kind of strange thing about faith, right? Like it's putting you're kind of putting your thinking on hold, and you're saying, this doesn't make sense, but I'm going to accept it. And kind of strange thing for God to want people to do the opposite of what he gave us a brain to do, or what we evolved to do. It's like, I'm going to give you this incredible thing, but I don't want you to use it. I want you to stop using it when, you know. And then how would you distinguish the truth from falsehood? I mean, for everything else in life, we allow ourselves to do the best we can, except when it comes to faith. Now, this special word, faith, we stop our brains and we say, well, I don't care if it makes sense, right? And I mean, it sounds kind of like, I want to say it sounds petty to say that, you know, someone says, I believe in gravity, but I don't believe in Allah. But the reality is that these are the type of things that, you know, like I had another friend that told me like a similar kind of funny story as you. Actually, it was Waleed. Shout out to We Do Wids. He told me
Hey, we do.
a similar story, which, you know, after he told it to me, he said it sounds so silly that like a small thing like this caused me like doubts. But the reality is, these little things, they poke holes in the impenetrable forest of Islam, and they shine the light, you know, and a little bit of light in the under the canopy, it comes to you, and you look out and you're like, that little hole, it, you know, it just gives you a little bit of something to think about. And then, you know, other things happen in your life, and you know, the light gets more and more, and eventually you see a way out of the forest, right? But like, it starts with these small things like, for me, you know, something very stupid sounding, I mean, to a Muslim, it might sound stupid sounding, was like, I started to wonder, like, you know, people that say, Subhanalladhi sakha lana hadha wa ma kunna lahu muqrinin inna ila rabbina lamunqalibun. I still haven't memorized. It's like stuck in my head from saying it so
Stuck
many
in your head.
times. Every time I went in the car, it's like, does this actually do anything? Like saying this? Because I was actually taught that this protects you. This is an adhkar. You're remembering Allah. It's good to remember Allah, whatever. But I was also taught that it protects you, right? Like it's a type of like dua for protection, right? And then I thought about it. I'm like, how does that work? Because we don't see that, right? We don't see any sort of difference. I remember one guy told me he was in Ramadan. He was coming for Fajr. He was so tired, he fell asleep and crashed his car. And I'm like, in the middle of Ramadan, the most holiest month, the guy is doing like ibadah, and like he almost gets killed for his belief. And so these little things started to like kind of poke at me, like what's going on here? Like this does not make. And then, you know, and then finally I found out about the Harvard prayer experiment that actually, like, they scientifically tested to the best they could whether there was any sort of healing effect, right, on prayer. And even they told, you know, they told one group, we were praying for you, the other group, but they didn't tell them. And lo and behold, the group that was told that we're making people are making dua for you or praying for you, it took them even longer to get better. It's like they felt anxious about it, like, oh my God, someone's praying for me, I need to get better. But they got like it took them even longer. So I mean, that's the problem, right? These things don't seem to have any effect, like you're saying. Like, as stupid as it sounds to, like, a believer, oh, ha, ha, he says he believes in gravity. The reality is there's no evidence that, like, prayer to Allah or Jesus or Ram or Krishna or Buddha or anybody, like, it doesn't seem to do anything, right?
It doesn't, you know, it doesn't materially affect the universe. And I think that's where you get the idea of, like, the supernatural and saying, okay, well, it's affecting a supernatural universe that we only glimpse. And that supernatural universe is the more important one, not this material one we're living in at the moment, the supernatural one. And that makes me think of, like, exactly what you said there. It seems like the tiny little things, and they don't seem to make sense. Like you say, it doesn't seem to make sense that if I say these words, it could be any words. I remember you posted something saying, oh, if I say yabba dabba do, I'll find my keys, you know, like, okay, I'll try that. You know, like, why don't we try it? Have a control group, the yabba dabba group.
Yeah.
And then you have your, you know, your group who are praying and saying dua.
Billah, whatever.
See if it works.
Yeah.
They just see if it works. Which one works better? Maybe yabba dabba doo does. You know, is that a placebo effect? But the thing of it not making sense made me think of Yasser Qadhi's little. You know, he got quite. It was a bit of a diatribe against ex-Muslims, I think. Yeah. You know, he was super angry, and super irrational. There you go. That's all it is. It's super irrational to us. An intellect, but your intellect, because you don't believe, is not expansive enough to comprehend the super rational. But then if it's super rational, it's not comprehensible to anyone's intellect because it's super rational, you know, it's beyond it. And those kind of things made me realize that people are, you know, like Muslims are finally recognizing there's people leaving. There's a lot of people leaving. There's a lot of people heading for the exits. There's a lot of people who may even be in the mosque today. It's Friday. Jummah prayer is around the corner from me. There may be people going to the masjid, and possibly the only reason they're going to the masjid is because it's a Pokemon gym. I remember seeing on part of a ex-Muslim Facebook group, an Australian one, and I remember one of the members posted a photograph that he'd taken on his phone during the khutbah. He was just like, oh look, I found some kind of Pokemon creature, you know, inside the mosque. And I was just thinking,
Pokemon Go, the game where you have to go and take, like,
so. And then that reminded me of people going on Hajj and posting things like atheist, you know, like little photographs of Atheist Republic, or your name, or Abdullah Gondal's name, you know, like going, well, I'm here because my family have essentially made me, or because I have to keep up appearances, but I don't believe this, you know. And I just thought, oh, how could you figure out how many people are actually like that, you know? That's is there an object, you know, sort of like an objective measure, some kind of test you could do to see whether when people say the Shahada, they're actually sincere? There is no objective test for sincerity, I don't think. Like, you know, and so there are so many people, I think, in the closet, a lot more than we think. It's kind of like the TARDIS.
Absolutely.
It's bigger on the inside than it is on the outside. And I think that's only going to grow. And I think if I looked at it as a kind of a, from a systems point of view, so from a dynamic systems point of view, sort of like if you, the way that people look at the weather, the way that people look at the flow of water, whatever, and if you apply that to human society, I think, like Malcolm Gladwell says about certain movements or certain ideas, there are tipping points. And I don't know whether we're approaching a tipping point or whether we've gone past the tipping point, but there'll be some kind of cascade effect where suddenly people will go look around and go, oh, look, that guy's saying it's all right to be ex-Muslim and he's just getting on with his life and life seems good for him. And that woman there, she's left and she's having a good life. without any need for religion. And then suddenly they'll just proliferate to a point where, kind of like in Christianity, where people can say, oh, yeah, I don't actually believe any of that. Would you like a cup of tea? Let's just sit down and be ourselves.
Yeah.
We don't have to have this overwrought, painful conversation all the time. It can just be, oh, well, I still accept you. Oh, that's all right. You don't believe. Not a big
Yeah,
deal.
exactly. I'll make dua for you, Berlin.
Thanks.
Like,
We'll make
oh
dua for this.
my God,
For
like
this
you'll
tipping
make dua
point.
for me. Okay, thank you. You're gonna make dua to someone I don't believe in. Okay, sure. I just want to kind of touch on one thing you said, which is the scientific method. I think this is like, honestly, it's such a simple idea, which is so profound in a way that, this idea of doing a, like the scientific method of doing a test, having a control group and like evaluating, isolating for one variable. It's such a great idea. And, it's like when we got this idea, we were able to use it and get so much out of it. And it's not necessarily the case that, like religion shouldn't be, tested with a scientific method, because there was many things, like could have been considered like woo-woo in the past, and through the scientific method, like hypnotism, we found like there's actual, it actually works, right? And so there's the realm of the paranormal, which is outside of like, let's call it reality. But like science can actually go into that, and when we understand something that we didn't understand before, it now becomes part of, like it's now natural. It's not supernatural anymore, right? Rational, whatever. So,
Super
I mean,
rational,
we can actually test these ideas, some of these ideas, and which is why I think my friend his Sultan, his favorite Burak, I don't tend to use that point because I feel like that's an example of something that's like otherworldly. But there's many things where religion and the world like mix, like dua. Dua is the best example. And to some level we can try to test it, right? I mean, we can try. We can come up with some conclusions that, like, for example, if 1,000 people made dua, 100 people, some of them to Krishna, some of them just talk to the plants, and some of them to Santa Claus, and some to Allah, which one would be more effective? And the answer is none of them. They're all the same. Even the guy that doesn't make dua, right? So like I'd like rather just talk to my plants. It makes me feel better, right? I mean, but some people, they want to talk to Allah, it makes them feel better. But at least they should know that it's not going to make a difference, but like maybe they'll feel better about it, right? And I wanted to ask you, like, you had a note for me, Timur Quran, preference falsification. What is that?
Oh, okay. So this is kind of going back to the thing of like being in the closet. So Timur Quran is an academic from the US. So I think he's Turkish born. And he's written a couple of books about, well, he's written one really good book called The Long Divergence about how Islamic law essentially held back innovation and progress within the Islamic world. Really, really good book, very well researched, really interesting points. But he also wrote a book years ago, back in the 90s, I think, called Public Lies, Private Truths. And essentially, he put forward this idea of preference falsification, which is that in public, people, because they do not want to rock the boat, they don't want to have an unorthodox idea, will essentially agree with people around them. But when they're at home, they'll speak the truth. They may speak the truth to people that they trust more. And it may be a complete binary opposite of what they've said in public. So that's the phenomenon of preference falsification. And when I read this, whenever years and years ago, and I read this and I read about this idea, I was just like, oh, I've done that, where I've kind of said, oh, I believe this. I've said, I used to say I still believed in Allah. I still used to, say the same words as anybody else. But I realized inside I didn't actually believe any of that. And that thing really struck me. So that's a really interesting phenomenon. It's like just observing how people are in public to say, okay, well, yeah, I believe that Allah is the only God and Muhammad is his messenger. But people may not actually believe that. They'll just say it. So I think there's a probably, like a large number of people who still do that. And I'm not, I'm not judging because I used to do that myself. And that fascinates me about why I did it. I think that's what fascinates me just as much as anything else. Okay, so what led me to do that? What caused me to be like that? What was going on in my, what were the neurological processes happening in my brain as to why that, or even what are the neurological processes that made me once upon a time believe that Allah existed, and then to slowly go to the point of going, well, Allah doesn't exist. What's the neurological process that actually is happening, sort of like the material process, in terms of saying, oh, well, I went from this thought to this thought to this thought, and then finally came to this thought. And so I'm always interested in, okay, well, what are the neurological bases for belief? Like you said about, if you could do a control experiment, if you can apply the scientific method to pretty much anything, you can apply it to, reasons for belief, like what happens, what makes us believe,
It's a very interesting question. Why is belief so, predominant in the world? Why do people believe? Why have some religions survived, right? I mean, I don't think we have time to get into all that, but I do want to ask you a couple of
No,
things that you've specifically mentioned. One of
no,
them was your psychological operations specialist student guide. What is that?
no.
And butterfly effect, something about butterfly effect you want to talk about?
Oh yeah, no. It's so like the with the butterfly effect, that's going back to, I won't talk about the specialist ops thing. That was just an interesting, weird thing that I found about Mushrikun. It was like a thing about people, essentially being, I guess, if you translated the word to hypocrite, but I kind of prefer the word crypto. So like you're a crypto religionist. You say that you belong to a religion, but you don't really. So there's a long history of that happening from the Jews in Islamic Spain, where they had to pretend to be Muslim, but then they'd go home and they'd still hold their Jewish ceremonies at home and were, externally pretending to be for their own safety. That was in Almohad, Spain. And with the thing of like the butterfly effect is, again, going back to the idea of a tipping point. Will there be a tipping point where more and more Muslims can come out and say, well, yeah, actually, I don't believe. Or I think there's a God, but it's not the God in the Islamic scriptures as described. Essentially doing away with the book, but still keeping hold of their idea of there being some kind of God.
Why is it called the butterfly effect? What does that mean?
Oh, so like the butterfly effect is a thing from chaos theory. So chaos theory. So say if you were to describe how a storm happens, you'd say there are a number of inputs that go to create a storm, but sometimes tiny, tiny fluctuations in a dynamic input into that system, into a complex system, can have a massive effect. It can build over time. Think of, say, turbulence. Think of tiny
So
changes in
are
an
you
initial condition can
uh-huh.
suddenly explode into a huge difference, a huge variation in what's happening. So the old idea is that a butterfly flaps its wings in China, and somehow the air from that is joined to all of these other air currents and low pressures and high pressures, and causes a storm in America.
Right.
So somehow that input was important to creating a tipping point. So it could be a small thing, it could be an idea, it could be a story about one specific Muslim coming out and saying, "Oh, I don't believe anymore." And suddenly the whole, there's a huge shift in ideas. There's a huge shift in the way, the worldview of, even within the Islamic world, of people going, "Oh, actually, yeah, I kind of see why that, what that boy's saying, that he's saying that he doesn't believe in this, and that's okay." And suddenly there's a shift, and suddenly there's a change, and then all of a sudden the Muslim world is essentially more accepting of people, of the heretics within its own community, of the free thinkers, of the people who think differently. And I think that's a good thing, because I think diversity and variation of ideas is great for society. It's a brilliant thing for societies, because it helps progress. It helps good change.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I was kind of curious about what you said about Islamic Spain. Was it not the case that the Jews were allowed to maintain the religion and the Christians too? Or was it, why would they permit?
Initially, yeah, initially, and then there was a guy called Ibn Tamut who was just a lot more hardcore. You know,
Oh,
he
okay.
became he was he was he essentially said to people that you have to convert. And there's plenty of, you know, classical scholars who used to
Debate.
say things like that. You know, would say like it's conversion or death.
Yeah.
And obviously that's a very hardcore literalist interpretation of the Quran, of certain verses of the Quran. So, but he kind of kicked off a period of time in Muslim Spain where Jews often fled. You know, like the great Jewish scholar Maimonides, I think, you know, felt unsafe there, and you know, was essentially saying that people were pretending to be Muslim just in order to survive.
Moses,
So
are you talking about
again,
Moses Maimonides?
Moses Maimonides. Yeah, so he even in his book, The Guide for the Perplexed, which is a great title, I love that title, for a book. Yeah, he said, you know, we had to, you know, there were people who were pretending to be Muslim from the Jewish community in order to survive, in order to keep doing business, in order to keep their livelihoods going. And I guess that was a complete flip from the earlier parts, the earlier era of Islamic Spain, where people were, you know, it was a lot more pluralistic. It was, I think, a bit of a golden age in terms of that, in terms of acceptance, in terms of flourishing of ideas. And you know, I think great science happens when you do have a diversity of ideas, when people can propose ideas and have them attacked or dismantled or prove, you know, or you know, have more evidence given towards them. So those kind of things flourish when you have a diversity of ideas. If you've got groupthink, can be so dangerous. I mean, it can also help people pull in a single direction and get things done, but if it's
It's,
adversarial to the truth itself,
yeah.
then groupthink is dangerous.
Having people, you know, giving people the ability to disagree definitely is a power that can correct your society and, you know, can help it to self-correct, you know, towards the truth. Because if you don't have, you know, free speech, then of course you can go towards, you know, fascism or dictatorship. And so it's definitely, yeah, it's definitely. Free speech is an important thing, right? It's a challenging conversation exactly where to draw the line, but yeah, you do need the ability to be able to challenge and criticize and you know, one thing that actually turns a lot of people away from Islam is the infighting. In the infighting in Islam, for example, historically speaking, you had some of the caliphs who would like torture even, for example, Imam Malik or Imam Ahmed bin Hanbal for having a certain view that the Quran was created or uncreated. And then the next caliph was Mu'tazila, and he was happy to say the Quran was created, and they would kill people that would oppose that, right? And you have Sunnis that say that Shias should be killed, and Sunni scholars that Shias are not Muslims. Some people say Ismailis, like if you look up Islam QA, the Salafi website, they say Ismailis are worse than Kufar. They're like hypocrites, the munafiq, right? Because they pretend to be Muslim. And that's what people are saying about Ahmadis in Pakistan right now. They're saying these guys deserve to be killed. And it's like, I think this actually causes people to leave Islam, because when they see this infighting, they're like, well, which version of Islam is the right one, and how do I follow, and how do what do I implement, and which. So yeah, I think that in a way it helps people to see that, because it's a man-made religion, right? So there's going to be a lot of these doubts and holes in it.
And it's, I think it's easier these days to see the diversity of views, to be introduced to that diversity. Whereas once upon a time, everything was, if you think about the oral tradition of spreading ideas, it was person to person. I had to say something to one person, and then that one person had to say something to someone else. And then things got written down, and then so the ability to transmit ideas became a lot quicker and could spread further. Because I can only shout so far as one person, but if I write a book, then it's like I'm shouting, 1,000 kilometers away. But then you had the printing press, and then the book could get spread much, much quicker. And now you've got, then you had, I guess, telegraph, you had newspapers, different kinds of print media. Now you've got the internet.
And if I
These
can just jump
diversity of
in.
ideas and can be,
I was gonna say, like, the Muslim world kind of, messed up a couple of times there. Like, for example, the printing press, the Ottoman Empire actually forbade it, and they considered it haram. They wanted books to be copied by hand by the scribes, especially religious books. They wanted to make sure that, you had ijaza, and so it would be certified. And I mean, if you think about it, like realistically speaking, you're more likely to have a mistake if you have someone doing it by hand, even if they're checking it, rather than having one manuscript that's like, approved, and then like you make like 10,000 copies of it. So it the Islamic dogma, I think you were saying, I forgot what you mentioned, wrote the book about it, how it actually caused a Muslim community to fall behind. And it's true, right? Like the printing press was haram for some point. At some point, people thought microphones were haram, and the camera has been haram for many years. Even coffee, for God forbid, coffees was haram too at some point. So that's the kind of sad thing. When you hold on to the like religious ideas, it can really hold you back as a society. When you look back on it, you're like, what? They considered the printing press was haram? Like, that's so stupid. Like, why would they say that? But at that time, they believed it, right? And they had reasons to believe it. And now it's just like, you laugh about it. It's like, how stupid could it have been?
Again, I think it boils down to that fear of people having a different idea. Going, oh, if they have a different idea, they can challenge our idea. And we don't want to spread a challenging of our idea because our idea is the only one. So that book I was talking about was The Long Divergence, again, Taimur Quran, and his thoughts and concepts on why Islamic law couldn't adapt to new innovations within the world because it had to be so literalistic and it had to be stuck in the past, essentially. But your point about the printing press is a good one, so I mean, I think was it Johannes Gutenberg who came up with the first printing press? And he got in trouble for it, essentially. People like, oh, this is a dangerous thing to start spreading ideas to people who won't be able to understand them. And then within Christianity, William Tyndale translating the Bible into English. He was burnt at the stake, I think, as a heretic, partly because of that, because that was a dangerous thing to do, that only the keepers of the sort of like the secret knowledge, the scholars, were the only people allowed to read the book. They had to explain it to everybody else. No one else was allowed to read it. So now that people are actually able to read the Quran or read the Hadith in various languages, and not just in Arabic, they can go, oh, this bit does not make sense, or this bit is dangerous to spread as an idea, or this bit fails humans as an idea. It made me think, I'm like, it's interesting that I've put in a point here in the notes about the brutality of that is mentioned in the Hadith, even bits in the Quran, chop the hands and legs from opposite sides and stuff. All of these things, if it's just in Arabic and you can't read Arabic and you're just saying the words, it can seem quite benign, it can seem beautiful and stuff, but there's a lot of brutality in there. And one point that was I found really interesting was a post that was made by a friend of yours and I on his Facebook page, and he was arguing a point that Muhammad was not a scientist. He was someone who was the ultimate kind of transmitter of moral values. Okay, so in trying to explain this point, to say that okay, we shouldn't look at the Hadith or his stories about him as being scientifically factual because he's not a scientist, he's instead talking about morals. So in trying this person in trying to explain the point brought up the Hadith about the camel herder who was killed by people who had converted to Islam. And they converted to Islam, and then they left Islam and they killed the camel herder and they stole the camels. So in the Hadith, which is Sahih as far as I'm aware, the Prophet sent some people in their pursuit. And they were caught and brought, and the prophet ordered their hands and legs should be cut off, and that their eyes should be branded with heated pieces of iron. Okay, so he put this hadith on his Facebook page, and there were Muslims in the comments going, oh, you shouldn't transmit such lies about the prophet. You should take this down. He would never say to torture people. And that kind of was like that sort of like cognitive dissonance of, look, you're able to spread the ideas, the true ideas that come from the book or the books. And that, as much as anything, is making people go, ooh, that doesn't seem like the work of some divine presence. That just seems like an angry man.
That's a good point. That's a good point that like yeah, you're making a very good point because most people don't know these stories, especially when you when the religion is filtered by the imams or and the you know the holy man or whatever, they're not gonna, I mean, to this day, even in the West, imams, sheikhs, maulvis, scholars, they do not talk about certain topics. Don't talk about Aisha fighting, Ali. Don't talk about that. Don't talk about, like the Battle of the Camel and all these things. They don't, they like this was, God forgive them, Muslims killing Muslims and, like all this dirty politics, which is what it was, dirty politics. Let's not talk about that stuff. But like it's online, you can find it. Like, I mean, of course, Shias are happy to bring this up because it puts Aisha in a bad light. But I mean,
Puts
Sunnis,
Ali in a better light kind of thing, yeah.
they don't want to talk about, like Sunnis don't want to talk about. Man, I was shocked to hear the story of how Omar cause a miscarriage with Fatima. Like, I was like, whoa, like he bust down her door and like, holy, like there's some of these things that happened that are like brutal. A couple of things I want to say, because you made a lot of good points, but I didn't want to interrupt you. The cognitive dissonance point you said about like how Muslims are shocked when they read these things about the Prophet. I had one example from my life where I could not accept, only one thing I can think of when I think of cognitive dissonance as a Muslim for me, because I accepted everything. I'm like, whatever the Prophet said, I'm accepting it. It's for the wives or whatever, right? But like one thing I could not accept was FGM. I couldn't I read the hadith that said, you know, cut the clit, whatever. I couldn't accept it. I'm like, there's no way he said this.
Just a little,
Just a little. I'm like, there's no way he said this. I knew for sure FGM is a bad thing. It has no benefit whatsoever. And I couldn't see how Islam would encourage that. And so I'm like, nope, it can't be true. I don't care. Other than that, I can't think of any examples of like actual cognitive dissonance as a Muslim. I'm sure there's small things. But anyways. One more thing I wanted to say, which was very interesting, which is what you said, was these issues of like, you know, burning people at the stake and like, you know, for example, Galileo and Bruno, what's his name? Anyways, like for example, of great scientists who were like, you know, like burned at the stake and like, like harassed for saying certain things. It's not only Islam. Islam is not the only civilization that has this problem. It's a human problem. And so when people like, I don't like when people say like Islam is something like specially like perverse about Islam, that it's never going to change and Muslims are always going to be backwards and the worst of the world or whatever. No, like issues, every community, the Christian and Jewish communities, when, thank you, Herr Sultan, Giordano Bruno. The other communities have the same problems, right, that Muslims are going through right now. And I truly hope that these issues will go away with time. I don't know what you think about that.
No, I mean, I think if I look at stuff that I see, that I've seen recently over the last 5-10 years, there's mosques that are LGBT inclusive, you know. I mean, obviously they're few and far between, but there are people going, oh, we want to shift. You know, people are kind of recognizing in themselves that they want to shift to a different format, a different doctrine, and that shift is happening. The shift is happening. I can see it. You know, there's online conversations, there's people talking about it and saying, well, you know, they are essentially either they're changing the interpretation or they are simply discarding parts that they don't like. That's kind of essentially what it boils down to. I think they are discarding parts of the Quran, they're discarding parts of the accepted classical sort of like doctrines around certain aspects of life, and they're just saying, no, I'm doing away with this. This is not harmful. This is not a rule that I need anymore, and it needs to be updated. It needs to be adapted to the world as it is now. It needs to evolve, essentially.
I find in the Muslim community, like right now, the reform is not like, nobody will say we're going to leave these verses behind. We're going to throw out these like surahs or whatever. But they'll find other ways to do it, where they'll say trajectory, hermeneutics.
Yeah.
They'll say not, you know, context. They'll say Aisha was, even if they accept that Aisha was actually 9, they'll say that it was a different time and place where people died young. And this is a reform. Like Hamza Yusuf has straight up come and straight up said, we don't need hudud laws anymore, which a lot of people hate him for saying that, like the hardcore Salafi / Hizb ut-Tahrir, you know, Islamic State people, guys, they're like, oh, you know, you're a traitor for saying this. We need, Islam's all about chopping off hands. Like, we're like a that's the most important thing in Islam, chopping off hands and stoning people. And like, it's such a like disgusting, like sad version of the religion that if that's what you believe your religion is about, like chopping off people's hands and stoning them and like Allah's law, right? Like, whereas like, you know, thankfully you have other versions of Islam where it's more about like your personal relationship with Allah, right? Which again, it's still a waste of time, but it's by all means, you're most welcome to do that, right? I mean, so yeah, reform, I think it's like a four-letter word in the Muslim community.
Yeah.
So you have to kind of like
bid'ah. Find different ways. It's bid'ah, isn't it? It's essentially bid'ah, all of this, you know, like all of these innovations that are happening. But I think I find it understandable that it is, because people are finding so many of the verses and stories about Muhammad to be incompatible with the way that they actually live their lives. And they're it just doesn't fit anymore. And I think that's the thing that which is why people have to do these kind of adaptations to try and adapt things, or like you say about the trajectory hermeneutics, and say, oh well, there's a trajectory and there's a plan, you know, there's a plan to it and it's evolving and God is the one in, you know, in charge of evolving it. Whereas actually it's just humans projecting their changing needs and their changing worldviews onto the book.
Yeah.
Not the other way around. And I think that's fair enough. That's, you know, people project themselves onto most books that they read. I just think it's a lot easier to do with religious books, and especially the Quran. It's easy to, you know, turn it into one giant metaphor.
Yeah. And so just to kind of wrap this up, because I think we went a little bit longer than expected. Wanted to ask you about positives. Where to from here? How do we keep this going? You know.
Yeah, because I mean, I see a lot of really good discussions between people who are still Muslim and people like you and me who've left. I see a lot of great discussions between people, respectful ones, enough to the point where people can have a bit of a joke as well. You know, kind of keep it a bit more lighthearted. I see, you know, people like, say, Osama Hassan, I guess, you know, like big names wise, like Majid Nawaz and stuff, who can have those different conversations that a lot of the Islamic world is still afraid to have. But I think that slowly but surely, I'm seeing that shift. I'm seeing a lot more acceptance from Muslim communities of people. And I'm hearing it as well from ex-Muslims. People, you know, like you say about your parents being pretty cool with, oh yeah, you've left the religion, so what? And I'm seeing that more and more, and it's not something I used to see, but I am seeing it now. And obviously that's anecdotal. That doesn't mean that anecdotal evidence is useless. Anecdotal evidence can be, you know, quite profound. I call it anecdata. So it, you know, it can be meaningful. It's not everything. It's not the whole picture, obviously. But I do hope that, you know, people such as yourself, and, you know, Harris and MTRs and XMNA and CEMB and Mariam Namazi, all these people, like, I hope they keep having these conversations with people, and they, you know, keep it, keep asking for respect and giving respect and fostering those platforms for people to talk, because that's going to help.
Absolutely. Yeah. And for my answer would be as well, like, whether, you know, if you're safe and you're independent financially and you can come out and you want to contribute in that sense, because the more people that come out, the easier it is for other people to come out. Of course, everybody has to make a personal decision. Don't shock your family members with like, "Hey guys, I'm ex-Muslim and look in my bag, I have a bottle of whiskey and I got some condoms and whatever." Like, I like a have a heart
Bacon
attack.
sandwich, yeah.
Just like take it easy. Yeah, ham sandwich. Just take it
Yeah.
easy. Like, maybe start asking some questions to your loved ones and see how they react and stuff like that, and take it slow and try to help them to see their point of view. In the long run, this will help everybody. I wanted to ask you, this has been an amazing conversation. You've given many, many, many
Thank
good
you.
resources. After the live is done, I'll add them to the description box. I wanted to ask you, is there anywhere we can find you? Are you do you have any sort of
Oh, look me
online?
up on Facebook. Look me up on
Okay.
Facebook, MH Talukdar.
Okay, I'll add a link.
And yeah, I'm only really on Facebook. I haven't got any other social media accounts. Or you can look up my website, which is probably for my upcoming novel, which is Kingdom of Hind, HINDH.com. And all one word.
Oh, we didn't talk about your book. Can you just
No,
quickly?
that's right. We'll do that another time.
Okay, fine.
We'll
Yeah,
do that another time.
just 1 minute description then. Just a short like. Because
Okay, very quickly.
I thought it was such an interesting like idea,
Idea, yeah.
alternate universe.
Something I was fascinated by as a child,
Yeah.
was Musaylimah,
Yeah,
the
yeah.
great liar, as he was
Right?
known. So I imagined a parallel universe where, at some pivotal point, Musaylimah had won the Battle of Yamama, and become known as the messenger instead of Muhammad. So it's kind of like my novel set about 1,000 years after that, in a different version of India.
Okay.
And how things had changed, what the difference is. But it's essentially about a man living in a religious dictatorship and how he deals with that. So
Very cool, very cool.
that's the fundamental premise of the novel. It's a
Very,
science
very.
fiction novel. So hopefully publishing that later this year.
Oh, awesome.
One thing I would like to say to people who may be in the closet, like to follow on from your point, is I think the one thing that I struggled with was self-acceptance.
Oh.
And I'd like to encourage people to accept their doubts, to accept who they are in themselves, independent of what the book, and even independent of what the community might say about them. I'd like people to say, to learn to foster that idea of accepting themselves, and that there is nothing wrong with their questioning, their doubt, their skepticism. And that's about it, really. There's nothing wrong with it.
That's a beautiful way to end it. This has been awesome. Let's do it again sometime.
Yeah, definitely.
Thank you so much, everyone,
Thanks, Abdullah.
for joining in and
Thanks, everybody.
having this conversation. The links to Murad's Facebook and his book will his website will be added after, and you can just check in the description. Okay, everyone, have a good day to you, and hopefully it's not the Day of Judgment. And let me know if it is.
Yeah.
I can be prepared.
Yep.
Yeah, take care, man. Okay,
Thanks,
bye.
Abdullah.